Blog Talk Radio.
With one D, T-O-D, from PA. You can follow me on Twitter, and it's a very special Run to Daylight podcast today, as I will be introducing and interviewing Derek Carty. Derek, you might recognize from his role on Baseball Tonight, or his articles at ESPN.com, or his occasional SportsCenter appearances. He's a longtime DFS player, and famously, for me anyway now, he's the creator of the Bat Projection System. Prior to Daily Fantasy, Derek honed his statistical chops as the fantasy manager of two of the biggest sabermetric outlets, Baseball Prospectus and the Hardball Times, and he's the only active fantasy writer to have graduated from Major League Baseball's exclusive scout school. Derek, are you with us? Maybe he isn't with us.
Can you hear me?
How about now?
Todd?
Hey, can you hear me?
I can hear you. You have me?
I can hear you. So how do you like the introduction?
That was quite the list you rattled off there. I feel accomplished. Thank you.
Well, actually, I thought of last minute. You know, well, as I was preparing for the interview, I looked at your fantasy boot camp presentation where I had seen you for the second time. And as I was going through it, they had, you know, Al and company had gone to the effort of putting that together. So I decided to be a little more professional than normal and use that. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm excellent. You know, first I want to get to the really important question I've been meaning to ask you. How often, or if ever, does anyone call you Rico?
Occasionally, especially in the year-long fantasy industry, the age curve's a little bit steeper. Like, a lot of the guys are, like, a lot older. So, like, the older guys will make that kind of reference occasionally. In DFS,
yeah, well, I'm 53, so I definitely resemble that remark. it seems that, you know, before we get too serious into the interview, that the one thing that everyone seems to talk about with you is the hair. I mean, people seem to be obsessed with your hair, and it's guys who are obsessed with it. I mean, don't you find that a bit odd?
Maybe a bit odd, but I have no problem with it. I think the hair is part of my personality. It's part of my persona, and I'm glad that people have taken to it.
Absolutely. I mean, anything, right? So tell us a little bit about your history, where you grew up, where you live.
I grew up in New Jersey, right along the beach.
What town?
That's where – what's that?
What town? I'm a Jersey boy.
I'm like right on the shore, right in the middle, like Belmar, Asbury, Seaside area.
Oh, awesome. I grew up in Scotch Plains, so about an hour north of you.
Okay. Yeah, not too far away.
Yep. So how did you get into fantasy baseball in the beginning?
In the beginning, I was in high school and I was playing in a fantasy baseball league with my friends, and I would lose every year and I didn't know why. And I found out that my one friend was into sabermetrics, and he was big on like Moneyball. It kind of, you know, been out a couple years now. And so I read that because he said that's, you know, why he was winning all the time. And so I read that and I fell in love with it. I was always really good at math. I love numbers and I love puzzles. And so it just clicked for me. Like, I was like, oh, this is perfect. I can combine my love of sports and math. And I just kind of started writing. I put up a Blogger blog. A couple months later, the Hardball Times noticed. They said, you know, we want to start a fantasy section. Will you come, you know, start it for us and be the face of fantasy for the Hardball Times? And I was like, fantastic. They were my favorite site at the time, like one of the best sabermetric sites. They merged with Fangraphs eventually. They're like, they're basically Fangraphs is like nerdier older brother.
Yeah.
And so, that's how it started. And then from there, it all kind of snowballed. You know,
that's kind of the equivalent of sitting at the front row of a Tigers game and having Kate Upton fall in love with you, right?
That would be quite the experience.
Well, I mean, getting your favorite site to notice you and ask you to have this career as a writer. I mean, it's almost a similar analogy.
It really is. So what you're telling me is you have a crush on Kate Upton, Todd.
Are there any red-blooded Americans that don't?
I don't think there are, honestly.
I mean, you know, no offense. Sometimes I will only look from the neck down. But, you know, that's a spoiler alert.
I think that's to be expected a little bit.
Yeah, it's fairly noticeable. So you wrote for them for a little while. Tell us a little bit about what that was like and how you went from one site to the other.
It was great because I got to work with so many smart people. Like a lot of the guys that I work with there are working for major league front offices now. Like Josh Kalk was one of the first like really good.
Can you say that name three times real fast?
Josh Kalk. Can't do it.
Nope. Didn't think so.
Yeah, I worked with him, and then he wound up moving on to the Rays, and he got mentioned in Jonah Carey's The Extra 2% book, which was great. But I got to work with some really smart guys who consulted with major league teams and stuff like that. And it was cool because I was like a part of this, you know, sabermetric community and working with some of the best minds in baseball and learning so much.
Yeah, that is really very interesting to me. Just to give you a little bit of my history, I was a huge baseball nut when I was a kid, but it manifested differently. There was no sabermetrics. It was, you know, we would play Strat-O-Matic baseball on our tabletop for hours at a time. And I read a book called The Glory of Their Times, which I immediately fell in love with and got into the whole history of the game. And I mean, I you know, like my parlor trick is I could still tell you who won every World Series back to 1903. But I kind of got disenfranchised by the game with the steroids and the no cap and kind of quit after 2002 and came back this year because of DFS. So I remember when I met you at the football boot camp in the fall that Grinders did. I mean, your whole thing went over my head because I just was so far removed from baseball. But, you know, while I was away, this whole industry of sabermetrics, which I had heard of, seemed to have grown up and become a really important factor, not only with fans, but with the people who actually run these teams.
Absolutely. I mean, it's you can't go anywhere without it now. Like, there's still a few kind of, you know, stubborn mainstream guys who are like, oh, sabermetrics are the devil, or we have who was it? I think Burke Y11 or Goose Gossage, maybe. Yeah, like a few weeks ago, like decrying the sabermetric community. But for the most part, like every front office uses it. A lot of mainstream writers use it now. Like it's everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an old Yankee fan from the 70s, so I'll always love Goose. But, you know, he's not exactly the type of guy I'd go to for life advice. So, how did you parlay that into going to scout school? I think that the whole scout school aspect and how you combine numbers with real world scouting is very interesting to me and something I want to get into a little bit.
Right. So that was something that I very much wanted to do. You know, after a couple of years at the Hardball Times, I kind of had this statistical background, but I knew that wasn't everything. You know, that wasn't the complete picture of a player. So I really wanted to go to scout school. But I don't know how much you know about it, but it's very exclusive. It's designed basically for major league teams. Every major league team, basically, to go, you need a sponsorship from a major league team.
I did know that. So the next question on my list was, how did you get sponsored?
Right. So every team only gets a sponsor, at least at the time, was like two people per year. So it was really hard. What I did was I had contacts from being with the Hardball Times, and I knew people who knew people. So I got put in touch basically with half the front offices in baseball. And I said to them, look, I want to go to scout school. Will you sponsor me? Do you have a free, you know, an open sponsorship? And most of them said no. Like, you know, we're sending, you know, so-and-so because we want them to be a scout, or we're sending so-and-so from the front office because we want them to understand the scouting process more. But eventually I was persistent and I just kept nagging teams. And I found one that said, sure, if you pay your own way, we'll sponsor you. And I was like, awesome.
And what team was that? And who gave you your big break?
I'm not allowed to say, actually.
Okay, fair enough. So you go to scout school. How long is scout school?
It's 2 weeks. 2 weeks of from the time you wake up until the time you go to sleep of learning about scouting and doing scouting and everything else involved with it.
What was your favorite part of scout school, and were there parts that you didn't enjoy?
Honestly, I don't think there were parts that I didn't enjoy, because when you're passionate about something like this, like you want to learn as much as possible. Like what I didn't enjoy was I wish it was longer. Like if it was 4 weeks or 6 weeks, like that would have been great. I would have loved to stay there longer. The best parts of it, though, were just learning from Major League Baseball scouts who do this for a living and who have done it for, some of them have done it for 50 years or 60 years. And just learning from them how to evaluate players with your eyes, which is so much more art than science, you know, relative to the statistical side of it. So it was a great experience.
How did going to, you know, like me going to the Roto Grinders conference, you know, so many times in life you get your hopes up for something, a concert or a date, and it doesn't live up to your expectations. Did scout school live up to your expectations and even exceed it?
Yeah, it definitely lived up to it. It probably exceeded it too. I mean, it's so long ago now. It was 2009. So what's that, 7 years ago? Man, I'm getting old.
You're going to be 30, and 30 is dipping your toe in the water of getting old.
Yeah, soon enough. But yeah, it was great. You know, it's hard to just pinpoint like one thing about it that I loved, but like, and it's cool. The cool part about it is now, because it was so long ago, like the guys that you watched and scouted and wrote reports on are like in the big leagues now, or like, I don't know, starting maybe 3 or 4 years ago, like you started seeing them. Like the very first guy I ever scouted was Billy Hamilton, who's like a household name now and gets played all the time in DFS because he steals a base every time he gets on.
Which is about once a week.
Yeah. Yeah, if he could learn to get on more, man, he would just be a monster.
He could be Ricky Henderson-like.
He really could. Maybe without the
I mean, I don't know if you were watching a game the other night where he was on first base and there was another guy on second base. I think it was Cozart. And he's not exactly a slow guy. He's a leadoff hitter. And there was a double hit into the gap. And Billy Hamilton had to slow down or he would have run over Cozart before home plate.
Yeah, I didn't see that, but that doesn't surprise me at all. Hamilton he's so fast.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I read the article that's on Grantland in preparing for the interview about the guy who went to scout school, and he was talking about how you go and most of your time is spent not finding anyone, and you're mm-hmm. telling us that you saw Billy Hamilton right out of the gate.
Well, they kind of like pulled a fast one on us. Like, they told us to watch this guy, and we're all sitting there with our stopwatches, because one of the first things they teach you, one of the easiest things is to grade a player's speed. So you time his home to first speed. And we're all looking at the stopwatch, and we're like, huh, is that right? Like, is that actually an 80-grade speed? Would he really go down the line that fast? Because it's like there's an art to, like, getting the stopwatch starting and stopping it at the right time. And so it kind of takes a little bit of a little while to get used to it and getting it right. And so when the first guy, all of us have, like, this crazy time on our stopwatches, we're like, can that be right? And then
right,
obviously
yeah.
we didn't
I
see
mean,
anyone else
and
like
it's
a
fun
time.
That they did that. And I wonder how much it was off of that Grantland article where that, you know, someone at scout school said, you know, we need to stack the deck a little bit just to kind of get their interest out of the gate.
Yeah, I definitely can see that. I think they wanted to show us, like, okay, this is 80 grade speed. Compare everything else to this.
Yeah, well, and, you know, you really don't know until you see the high end what medium and low is.
Exactly.
I like that. I like that they did that for you. So one of the questions I have is kind of off the track of the scout school in a sense, but do they incorporate any of your numbers and what you had learned beforehand at scout school, or is that pretty much off the table?
That's off the table. That's beyond the purview of scout school. They do nothing with numbers. It's all about the tools.
Well, the only thing about scout school, there's no advanced numbers, but they do have a pretty extensive grading system that they use to grade the different skills of the players. Could you give us a quick rundown on how that works?
Right. So the scouting scale is 20 to 80. So 20 is the lowest possible score and 80 is the highest possible score. Both scores are very rare. 80 is like Billy Hamilton's speed, or like, you know, prime Adam Wainwright's curveball, or Clayton Kershaw's curveball, or like, you know, a guy who throws 100, or Aroldis Chapman's velocity is an 80 grade velocity. And everything else is kind of in between, 50s average, and it kind of goes from there.
Gotcha. All right. So that is interesting. So what did they teach you to look for, and like with pitchers, what was the most important thing they taught you to look for in grading a pitcher?
It was his stuff. Like, they taught us how to identify pitches by how they moved. What's a fastball? What's a changeup? What's a slider? What's a curveball? And then they taught us kind of the different types of, you know, the different ways it can break and the kind of things that you're looking for with it. And grading pitches that way. And then different kind of mechanical things to look out for too.
Right. And I would think that would be important, because they want to make sure that, you know, especially when it comes to pitchers' arms, that they've got a motion that would allow them to have a decent length in their career.
Absolutely. They're really big into projectability too. And like the body type. So like guys who are like kind of, you know, bigger and sturdier, they tend to think might, you know, hold up better, which, you know, makes sense. It isn't always the case, but that's one of the things that they kind of harped on a little bit too.
From my dark recesses of my memory of listening to the Moneyball audio, there was a catcher who was a complete failure, but they liked his college sabermetrics. Do you remember that whole story? What was that guy's
name?
Jeremy
Brown, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's funny how the two of those are kind of opposed. So explain how scout school narrowed your field of vision when watching from watching baseball, and has it increased or made you feel a little more mechanical when you're watching the games?
Yeah, I guess it depends on the purpose of why I'm watching the game. If I'm watching the game because I want to get a take on a guy, then I will focus in and look at, you know, particular things that I want to see. But I also, you know, occasionally I'm just a fan of the game in general. So a lot of times I will, I'll just kind of try to watch it and, you know, zone out all the little minutiae and just kind of enjoy it.
So, yeah, so that you have that ability. That's interesting. So what would you say, let's finish up with Scout School and get to what most of us get to know each other from, which is Daily Fantasy. How do you think what you learned at Scout School makes you a better Daily Fantasy player?
I think it definitely makes me a better Daily Fantasy player because the numbers aren't everything, and the numbers are so widespread now, and everyone knows the numbers, you know, for the most part. They're out there. There's still mistakes being made and, you know, whatnot, but the intelligence level with the numbers is so much higher than it used to be. But with the scouting, no one has that really. So the way I always look at it is the numbers kind of tell you what happened, and the scouting tells you why it happened. So the numbers may say that a guy is doing this well, but we don't necessarily know if that's sustainable, and the scouting can help us figure that out.
Gotcha. So how did you go from scouting school and writing for those companies to getting into Daily Fantasy and then coming up with the bat?
How did I get into it? I was obviously writing about stuff, and I was looking for, you know, I was kind of a struggling writer. I wasn't making a ton of money, so I was looking for different gigs and different ways to make money and different places to write. And FanDuel was a thing. And so I got an offer to write articles at FanDuel, and I started playing Daily Fantasy with them and kind of analyzing things from the daily mindset, and I kind of fell in love with it. Like, it was just perfect. It was like more analytical than the season long game. So many more different factors to consider. And I ran with it from there.
Yeah. I think Daily Fantasy might even be more addictive than Kate Upton.
I think just,
you know,
especially as
you get older.
What's that?
Especially as you get older. So, how did you come up with the bat? What did you put into it then, and how has it grown since its infancy?
Well, it started before Daily was even really a thing, I think, or like when it was just starting out. And it started as a year-long fantasy system that I could use in my leagues. And then as I kind of built it from there, I realized, you know, I can tailor this to Daily, and then I can, you know, potentially create something great. And so it still had all the same... you know, the same core of like projecting players using sabermetric methods. And then I threw on all the different daily layers to make it applicable to DFS.
And how much do you think that you add to the bat in the off season each year? And do you work on it and tweak it during the year?
Yeah, I the biggest upgrades are made in the off season. And then during the year, I still make a ton of them. I made one that I was pretty excited about just yesterday, actually.
I got to ask, what was that?
So I want to project innings better for pitchers. I was watching Johnny Cueto a couple nights ago, and I'm like, why is Cueto? Because Cueto put up a huge game, and I paired Liriano with Pomeranz, who were both good, but they both only lasted.
By the way, I paired Liriano with Pomeranz too, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah, so I mean, they were good, but they only went 5 or 6 innings, and then Cueto threw a complete game. And I'm like, well, why did Cueto throw a complete game? Like, he got so many extra points at the end just because he threw a couple extra innings. And so I tweaked the system. I realized I wasn't accounting for a pitcher's ability to go deep like that. And so what I did is, first, I used pitch counts for each pitcher based on, you know, their past history, you know, kind of adjusted for a couple little things. But then I also project his pitch efficiency. So the way that works is basically a pitcher who allows a lot of walks is going to run his pitch count up very quickly. A pitcher who gets a lot of strikeouts is not. And then guys, you know, who get a lot of balls in play, basically the way what's the best way to describe it? So balls in play take about 3.5 pitches per ball in play on average. Strikeouts are like 4 and walks are like 5, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But every time you allow a ball in play, it's not always going to be an out. So sometimes it's an out, sometimes it's a hit. So in general, you want strikeouts the most, then balls in play, and then walks, because walks are no outs and the most pitches.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right. So I project basically pitch efficiency now, where guys who are being the most efficient, not allowing a lot of walks, are are going to be projected for more pitches and thus more innings. And it kind of bore out last night a little bit. Jose Quintana, after I made this change, jumped up towards the top of my projections. And he had a bad inning in like the seventh, but up until that point, he threw like, I don't know, like 65 pitches through six innings or something, because he doesn't walk any batters and because the Royals don't take any walks. So he is being incredibly efficient up until that point. I was like, oh, I think I'm onto something here.
Yeah, I like that. And you know, one of the things you and I talked about at boot camp was, and just as a note to anyone who's listening, any of my three listeners, I used the bat. I signed up for it right after the boot camp. My reasoning for doing it is that I have about an hour or two a day, and I know that I'm not good at what Derek is good at. So do I just take the bat and blindly use it? No, I don't. But it gives me a tremendous head start every day in what I'm looking for and in my research. And I forgot where I was going to take that, Derek. But basically, I wanted to let everyone know that I use the bat and I really like it. And what we're going to do after we get through a few more questions is we're actually going to go through what the bat looks like today. And then I'm going to ask some questions so that if you're not a bat user yet, you want to get it, because it's only $150 for a year. And with advanced math, how many games are there a year, Derek?
There's usually about 180 days. So, yeah.
So, using advanced math, how much is that a day?
that's less than a dollar a day. I think we're maybe a little bit over now since we're into the season a little bit, but it's still, if you're playing any kind of volume, it's really not a heavy investment.
Right. So for less than a dollar a day, you can get the bat and you can take from it what you want. You can tailor it. Derek has an excellent video explaining how he uses the bat and how you can use it. And then you can use your own ability and your own ingenuity to play with it some more. So I'm a big fan of it. And one of the things that I've noticed in the industry is you end up in these discussions, you know, like one is batter versus pitcher. And another one is projection system or no projection system. And I find it an interesting, if fruitless, argument. Obviously, we know where you come down on it. But can you tell us why someone who just goes from their gut is going to completely miss a big portion of what's important?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to approach that question. First, I think if you're just going from your gut or you're just kind of eyeballing the matchups, sometimes you will miss something. You'll rule a guy out and have the platoon advantage, or because he's up against a good pitcher. But he might be a good value anyway if his price is low and if the rest of the matchup is good. And so a projection system can catch a guy like that. Like last night, the bat thought Freddie Freeman was a top 10 first baseman, and he was up against Aaron Nola. And so nobody played Freeman because Nola's good. But Freddie Freeman was cheap, and the rest of the match was good. He had the platoon advantage. He was in a good park. And so I mean, obviously, Freeman hit two home runs. It's not always going to work out that well. But, like, that's the type of guy that the projection system can help you find.
Yep, and it also can help you with recency bias. You know, it's human nature. I hear it all the time. Well, I played Stanton. He struck out four times. What a dog. You know, and right now Stanton is putting up over fours they're going out of style, but he's still someone who's going to show up very highly on the bat from day to day.
Absolutely. The bat doesn't necessarily buy into guys who are, you know, on a little bit of a cold streak like that. Just because Stanton's history is so good that you know that the underlying talent for Stanton is there. So if he's in a good matchup, the bat is going to like him. That being said, go ahead.
Well, no, finish what you were going to say.
That being said, there is a user component too. Like, you don't necessarily have to just follow it blindly and play Stanton. If you think Stanton is, you know, really cold right now and you don't want to risk him putting up another 0-for-4, you don't have to play him. Like, sometimes guys, there's something off mechanically or psychologically, or they're playing hurt, And so the bat isn't going to pick up on that because it's a statistical system. So the user needs to intervene a little bit.
Yeah, I think especially with pitchers, you have to be careful because a lot of times when their arms are hurting or tired, they're, you know, it's human nature for a pitcher not to want to tell someone that he's hurt. You know, they don't even want to admit it to themselves. And so that's one that I do think I spend more time questioning what the bat tells me with a pitcher than I do with a hitter.
And that makes a lot of sense. I think it's a lot easier for a pitcher to be kind of broken than it is for a hitter.
Absolutely. One of the guys that always seems to come up very high on the bat, and there are just some guys that the bat loves. I think the bat Jesus is, if you'll excuse the expression, is Sano of Minnesota. Can you speak a little bit about why he tends to come up? And should people get a bat hood ornament of Sano?
They absolutely should. I love Sano, and the bat loves Sano. And the reason why is a matter of skill set. The bat tends to like guys who are power hitters more than guys who are contact hitters. So people have kind of asked, you know, I've gotten questions of, you know, of a given day, like, should I play Sano or should I play like Adam Eaton? And usually for me, the answer is Sano. And here's why. So Sano, a lot of his skills are based on his power. They're based on his walks. You know, his strikeout rate is a big part of who he is as a player. And these are things that are very stable. They're much easier to predict than things like hits on balls in play, which is what drives a lot of Adam Eaton's value. So if you look at it statistically, it takes about what's the number here? It takes about 150 plate appearances before you can say that a hitter's home run rate is just as useful in predicting his future home run rate than just assuming he's league average. It takes about 150 plate appearances. To do the same thing for hits on balls in play, it takes 1,300, so 8.5 times more plate appearances it's going to take for us to have the same level of confidence in a hitter's batting average on balls in play than it will for his home run rate. That's huge. That's a huge difference. And so for a system that is entirely statistically driven, we're going to be projecting home runs more extremely than we are hits on balls in play. So home run hitters are going to project better than guys who are deriving their value on hits on balls in play, because we can't tell for sure whether the guy doing that is doing it legitimately or not. And then it helps also that home runs, you get so many more points for. So,
yeah, you know, it's interesting because Stanton, a lot of times when he comes up for cash games, I tend to sub him out. And again, if you look at the video that Derek did to support the bat, he does talk about subbing people out. And I do tend to do that because he is so hit or miss. But, you know, I think one of the criticisms of the bat is it's more of a cash game thing than a GPP thing. But what you're telling me here makes me think it's just in its own way just as good for predicting GPP performance.
Absolutely. That's a very valid way to look at it. The projections from the bat are – they're mean projections. They're sorry. Let's say Sano is projected for 0.2 home runs today. If we were to play out this exact matchup millions of times, essentially what the bat is saying is that on average, Sano would hit 0.2 home runs. Some games he would hit one, some games he would hit two, a bunch of games he would hit zero, but on average it would be 0.2. But that doesn't account for variability at all. With a guy who's projection is driven primarily by home runs, it's such a low occurrence event that there are going to be a lot of games where it's zero and he's not giving you any points. And so that variability is something to take into account when you're playing GPP versus cash. But on average, Sano is a great play in a lot of matchups.
Yep. And again, you know, one of the great things you've partnered up with Roto Grinders this year. Why don't we touch on that real quick? In the past, you worked through someone else. Why don't you tell us some of the advantages that you've had in partnering with RotoGrinders?
Well, RotoGrinders is great. I was with Fantasy Insiders the past couple of years, and my experience there was awesome as well. A great group of guys. They really embraced me and kind of brought me into the DFS community, and I'm really thankful for that. They're phenomenal. But I moved to RotoGrinders this year, and I'm absolutely loving it. Obviously, they're the biggest DFS content site out there. The exposure has been great. The community there is really what I love, especially doing like the Grinders live shows and reading through the chat room during the shows and, you know, kind of being able to interact with the people and stuff like that. It's really been a lot of fun.
Awesome. And again, I got to start getting through some of these questions if we're going to actually get to some practical things. But I advise anyone to listen, check out the video. And that was one of the things that led me to wanting to do this. So you talk a lot in your boot camp presentation about embracing variance. Can you just, you know, give us the 30% to 45%, take on embracing variance and why that is so important in playing Major League Baseball DFS?
I'll give it a shot. Variance is everywhere in baseball. We all know it. Guys like to know they can either put up 21 runs or 20 points with a home run and a couple RBIs. Sorry. Or they can put up zero.
You're down to 20 seconds now. go take the time you need.
But it's important just to realize that the variance is there and to try and vary around the highest number possible. And a projection system can help you do that. Having that kind of precision and accuracy, you know, you're varying around a higher total number of points than if you're just kind of, you know, picking and choosing players by hand and maybe not getting the absolute optimal best plays.
Right. So I'm looking at the bat right now. Anyone who has the bat can look at it and looking at the 405 slate, David Ortiz comes up first at 9.74 points on DraftKings. Okay, if you cycle it by first baseman, the next guy down is Joey Votto at 8.57 and then Miguel Cabrera at 8.3 and Paul Goldschmidt at 8.23. So one thing the bat doesn't take into account, and it can't, I imagine, is ownership percentage. And for cash games, that doesn't matter. But for GPPs, it's very important. And so with variance, the difference between 8.23 and 8.30 and 8.23 is not a lot. And that's why Derek does tell you to look over what it gives you and, you know, tweak it a little bit.
Absolutely. Especially at first base where there's so many good players and so many good options, they can be bunched up like that. And so in a GPP, if you see, you know, the chalk guy is only projected for, you know, an extra couple tenths of a point more than the next guy who you think is going to be really low owned, then maybe that's the kind of play that you want to make in a GPP.
So you're only as good as your projections is something that I believe very strongly in. What do you think, you know, why do you believe that people should purchase the bat and that your projections are better than what they can either get elsewhere or do on their own?
I think it's because I come with such a heavy background in statistics. I don't think anyone has the sabermetric background that I do. And I don't think anyone is approaching things the same way that I am. My throat's bothering me.
That seems to be a thing with you.
Yeah, it's I don't know what's going on today.
I think God blessed you with great hair and a weak throat.
could be. Yeah, you can't have everything, can you?
No. I got a good voice, but no hair.
I think just the methodology behind it is so much sounder than other systems that I've seen because I come from that background, because I am accounting for, you know, the possibility that what a player has done is by chance and not just taking his numbers at face value. And because the bat accounts for so many different factors, like I don't think any other systems out there are accounting for, you know, for umpires or for catcher pitch framing or anything like that.
Well, and again, you know, I asked you that question because after meeting you, I felt comfortable. No projection system is going to be perfect because, you know, you're only as good as the information you put in. But I feel that you have the type of mindset and the due diligence to put out a very, very strong product. And it's why I do recommend it whenever I get the opportunity. So moving on, explain safer pitching, riskier bats.
So the general theory in DFS is in your cash games, you want you want safer pitching. You want the ace who is you know, going to give you a high floor. And then because bats, there's so much variance to begin with, you know, Mike Trout can be in the best matchup ever and still go 0-for-4. So the theory goes that you embrace the safer pitching and then you just deal with the variance in the bats.
Yep. In your video, you use an optimizer to maximize the bat. How important do you think it is to use an optimizer?
For me, I think it's very important, especially for cash games. For GPPs, much less so because ownership levels are such an important factor to consider. But for cash games, an optimizer can help you find the best combinations of players and kind of get as much value as possible into your lineup so that you're varying around the highest number possible.
Yep. Do you ever lock certain people in before you optimize, especially starting pitchers, considering you believe in safer pitching and riskier bats?
Definitely a viable option to lock in those safer pitchers. You know, and as a cash game strategy, that's a very viable one, and it's going to give you that safer floor with your pitchers. I don't always do it. Sometimes if there's a really cheap pitcher and a good matchup, I will kind of be a little bit more willing to take that risk than a lot of people are, but it comes down to personal preference a little bit.
I tend to play more GPPs than cash, so I tend to do it both ways, and I'll run lineups out there both ways.
Yeah, I think it's important, too, to play your cash lineups in your GPPs. You might not necessarily take the GPP down, but there's so much dead money in GPPs from people trying to take it down that your cash lineup can still turn you a profit.
I agree 100%. I always do that. Or as Dave Lofgren said during his presentation, basically, don't be a putz. Play your cash lineup in GPPs so that you don't want to beat yourself over the head with a hammer if it would have won.
Absolutely.
So does the process change in using the optimizer? You already answered this a little bit, but I've got it written down, so I'm going to ask it. Does the process change for cash games and GPP? You mostly play cash games, but how would you advise changing things up for those who want to use the bat for GPPs?
I think some of the best ways to do it is to do a lot of extra research, figure out who's going to be high owned, and then see which guys the bat likes that aren't going to be high owned. If you can find guys like that, you can lock them into your lineup, find that core that you want, and then let the bat or the optimizer kind of fill in around it with good value plays that it likes.
Something that I've started doing with the bat, if you know the bat, on the right side, things are in blue, green, yellow, and red. Blue is the best, followed by green, then yellow, then red. And so I'll take that and put it on a spreadsheet, and then I'll sort by dollars per point. And I'll take like a certain amount and make them the dollars for point people blue, and the same thing with green. And then I'll sort it by team, and then I'll look for teams that have five or six people with blue and green both in the fantasy points as well as in the value. And I only did it last night, and it didn't work out. But I'm not discouraged because last night was kind of one of those variance nights and you can't be discouraged about that. You know, one of my sayings about daily fantasy is a good daily fantasy player is like a good cornerback in football. You need to be able to get burned without letting it get to your head.
Absolutely.
So sometimes optimizers bring up guys I don't want for certain style games. I already did that one. I'm sorry. So I guess that why don't we kind of go through the optimizer right now, see what comes up, and then we can take that and use it to make a lineup for a GPP.
Let's do it.
All right. So I'm going over and I'm going, and I know if you do it at the same time, it might not be the same. But let me make sure I get the slate right. We're going to do the 4 o'clock slate, 7 games. We still have enough time to get a lineup in, hopefully. I'm going to click find optimal lineup instead of find multiple, since time is limited. And the lineup that we have is Jacob deGrom and John Neese as pitchers. How do you feel about that combination today?
I think that's the early slate, right? Are we doing the early or the late?
I got the 4:05, but I can do it just for the last five games. Hold on.
Right, 4:05. Okay.
Let's go back to the pool. I'll do it for the late games. That makes more sense anyway. Although it's five games, one of the things you mentioned in your presentation is, and I think this is important, and it's a way to take advantage of the bat. Is the bigger the sample size, the better the bat's going to be. And I've had a lot of success so far using the bat on all-day slates on DraftKings, where I can take advantage of that larger sample size and then change players as news comes up.
Right. The more players that you and your opponents have to pick from, the more opportunities for mistakes that your opponents have to make for them to pick non-optimal plays. If there's only, five games, a lot of the best plays often are going to be really high owned, and so there's less edge.
Yep, that was one of the things that stuck out from your presentation. So I just ran the optimizer that RotoGrinders gives you, where you can either use the RotoGrinders projections, or if you've paid your less than a dollar a day, you can have the bat. And believe me, I've played with them both. There's a huge difference. Nothing against the Roto Grinders guys. So the two starting pitchers that came up was Alex Wood, who is kind of the pitching equivalent of Sano, and John Lester. What are your thoughts on those two guys as starters today?
I love Wood. I love Wood almost every time he takes the mound. I know people get on me about it, but he turns in really good games. Alex Wood is a better pitcher than most people credit him for. And for so long, he was so cheap that he was like a must play in almost every matchup. Now DraftKings has kind of picked up on it a little bit. He's 9.1K today. But the matchup is still a really good one. He's in Petco against the Padres. So I love Alex Wood today. I think he's easily should be in all of your cash lineups.
All right. Well, here's one that could give us a little bit of pause, and it's a way I think that you can consider tweaking the bat. So John Lester is the other gentleman who came up, and look, he's a great pitcher. It's not a bad matchup, but he plays for a manager. You talked about getting longer into games. If it's a close game, Madden's going to pull him for a pinch hitter. What are your thoughts on Lester today?
Definitely. That's actually part of the changes that I made a couple days ago that I was talking about, where I account for pitch counts. So for guys that Madden does pull early sometimes, like Hendricks and Hamill, their initial projected pitch counts are going to be lower to kind of account for that. There's still going to be the variance. There's still going to be the starts where, they get pulled after 75 or 80 pitches. I think it's a little bit less of a concern with an ace like Lester. I think he tends to let him go a little bit longer, but it is definitely something to consider. But in such a good matchup, the best park for pitchers in baseball, a Giants team that is particularly poor against lefties because they have so many lefties, Belt and Crawford and Panic and whoever else. I do like Lester tonight.
All right. So I'm going to stick both of those into our lineup, John Lester and Alex Wood. And, we do lose DeGrom by not being in the seven-game slate. So catcher is Buster Posey, Prince Fielder at first base, Derek Dietrich at second, Adrian Beltre at third, Carlos Correa at short, Kiki Hernandez, Bryce Harper, and Giancarlo Stanton in the outfield. What are your thoughts on that team, and what, if anything, would you look at to make changes?
So one of the things that sticks out to me initially is Posey in there. Because we're playing Lester, Posey is against Lester. And I know that's something that a lot of people shy away from. For me, I'm less
inclined. For good reason.
For good reason. For me, I'm less inclined to change that today. Because we're dealing with a five-game slate, there just aren't a lot of options, especially at a position like catcher. And Posey, it looks like, is 3K. So he really doesn't have to do that much to meet that price tag. If Posey gets a couple hits or he gets a double or, you know, a hit in an RBI, he's going to meet value. So in this scenario, it's very possible, you know, maybe even probable that Lester and Posey both turn value in the same lineup.
All right. So the next person, Prince Fielder, is a guy that I don't love, to be honest. I like Mitch Moreland more. They're the same price. Other options that we could fit in are Justin Bour, Pedro Alvarez, Brandon Belt, Ryan Zimmerman. Are you on the Fielder train today, or are you, you know, like one of those other guys I mentioned?
Yeah, so Fielder's a guy that I can see pulling out. He is cheap. He's 3.3K. He's in a good matchup. It's a good park, you know, fly ball pitcher. But Fielder has been so bad this year and so bad lately that he's one of these guys that I can see kind of I can see excluding him. In the lineup builder, there's an exclude button. Because he's just been so bad, and if there is something wrong with him, the bat's probably not quite picking up on it yet. So I can see excluding Fielder and maybe seeing what else it gives us.
All right. Well, before we do that, let's go through the rest of the positions, because maybe we could downgrade somewhere else and not just be limited to the six guys Prince Fielder's price or lower. And that's a tip that I will give out to the people in the audience and something that I do. Second base, Derek Dietrich. What are your thoughts?
I like Dietrich a lot today, actually. He's in second base in your lineup?
Yep.
Okay, he's at third for mine, so we might have loaded it at different times. The projections update a lot throughout the day. But yeah, I like Dietrich today. Sorry, my computer was having issues. He's leading off. He's a guy who has a big platoon split. And he's facing Joe Ross, who I think is overrated. People, I don't know, they tend to love Joe Ross for some reason, but he's a pretty mediocre pitcher. So leading off at home for that price, I love Dietrich.
All right. Now, at third base, we've got Adrian Beltre at 3.5. So if we've got Dietrich with the ability to move over, now this is something else that I tend to do. I have the bat on one tab and I have my lineup built on another. So I go over to third base and I'll sort it by salary. Well, I won't even do that. I'll keep it by fantasy points. And around 3.5, the first guy who comes up is Danny Valencia. Brandon Drury's 3.2. Jung Ho Kang is 3.3. Do you like Beltre better, or do you like moving Dietrich over to he's at second base, right? I'm sorry, I did that wrong. Let me go to second base at 3.4, Brandon Phillips, Starlin Castro 3.1, Neil Walker 3.6. So do you like Dietrich better at third base? Is there another third baseman you like more than Beltre around that price point? What are your thoughts?
No, I think either way that works. I think Beltre is in a really good spot today. The lineup that I pulled up has Dietrich at third and Rougned Odor at second, so another guy from that Texas lineup. So I think either combination is a good one.
All right. I'm going to go with – where's Odor batting? He was moved but down to sixth or seventh.
He was, but – Su Chu got hurt again last night, so Odor is back in the leadoff spot.
All right, so let's go Odor and Dietrich at third. And that's something else that you talk about. You know, if there's a tiebreaker, having someone batting first versus fourth or fifth where Beltre is, you know, you might get an extra at bat. That could be the difference.
Absolutely. I think batting position is so important and so underrated by a lot of people in the DFS community.
All right. So we've got Carlos Correa at third base, another guy that the bat tends to love because he's so much better than the tends to be the people beneath him. Do you think he's in a good spot today? I mean, that is the place, if we don't like him, we could really look to move down and use money elsewhere.
Yeah, we could definitely save money there, but the bat likes the Astros the most of any team today. It has them projected for the most runs scored, and Correa is their best hitter. He's the best shortstop in baseball. I think Correa is a great play today.
All right, so that leaves us with the outfield and Kiki Hernandez. Have we gotten any word if he's playing today?
We have not gotten any word, although against a righty, it may not be entirely likely.
All right, so that's a spot we need to look at. And then we've got Bryce Harper and Gio Stanton. As mentioned, I just don't think Stanton is looking good right now. He's the guy that I would love to see who else the bat loves. And Harper, as good as he is, I mean, he's just been walking a tremendous amount lately. And when you're paying, I mean, he's only 4-6 today, but when you're looking at that kind of salary, is Harper someone that you really want in a GPP today?
He's a guy that I've found myself excluding a lot lately, not because he's not, you know, the best hitter in baseball, which he is, but just because of the way they're pitching him. Like, he doesn't get a chance to show that talent as much lately. And so I can definitely see taking him out.
All right. So I'm going to make an executive decision because we're running a little low on time. You and I can keep recording, just so you know, if we get the last couple minutes, we can keep recording and it will be there for posterity. And once it's posted, people will be able to hear the end. But what do you think about sticking Altuve and Springer in?
I definitely like Springer. I like Altuve too, but I think leading
off,
I think Odor is the play because you're going to save almost $2,000 over Altuve. So,
oh wow!
So
I
even though
Altuve was that cheap, no, you're absolutely right. All right, so trying to get this in. Let's look at the bat. This is something I make lineups regularly with the Motown Mauler. When you get most of your lineups in, one of the things we like to do is, the average remaining salary is $3,233, and this is the part of building a lineup where you want to use a little bit of finesse, I think. Don't you?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, who does the bat love around $3,000 in these positions? Do you have any really good value plays? Maybe Mazzara today?
Is Mazzara in the lineup today? Mazzara's batting seventh today, so that's why he's fallen down. I don't think he's the best.
No interest there. All right, so around 3.2, I'm going to throw some names out at you. Hunter Pence is 3.4. Puig is 3.5. Let's see, So Lair is 3.2, Joey Rickard 3.1, Span 3,000, Reimold 2.9. Do you have any? Ben Revere is 2.8. Yeah, Taylor's out today, by the way, if anyone's keeping track. Ryan Rue is 2,300. Anybody jump out at you in that grouping?
Honestly, that price range today, there's not a lot of guys that I like. I would almost rather drop down to 2.1K for Chris Heisey and then upgrade somewhere else.
All right. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to deal with the Heiseys and the lows. So Heisey is in, leaving us 3,800. Let's go back to first base. And do you like Justin Bour or Mitch Moreland today?
Let's do Moreland.
Yeah, that's who I like, especially with Odor in. And that leaves us 4-3, which gets us Ian Desmond, Stanton, Yelich, Gattis, Adam Jones, Trumbo, who I almost always like, for GPPs. Another guy I really like that is underneath there is Marcell Ozuna. Who do you like? We got 10 seconds, and then we will keep doing the show. You can check it out with the link after.
Well, since you don't want to play Stanton because of his cold streak, how about Gattis? And that way it gives us a little bit more Astros exposure since we have a few of those guys already for a GPP.
We can do that, but before we do that, I am obviously showing a recency bias. Tell me why you might want to play Stanton. If that's the right play and I'm building a lineup with you, let's have a quick conversation about that.
Stanton, I would need to dig into a little bit more because, like you said, he's been kind of cold lately. But he's so cheap that, like, for 4.2K for one of the best hitters in baseball, it's appealing. But if you look at the
bat, especially for a GPP, I'm going to stick Stanton in there because this is a GPP, and if I have a recency bias, so do a lot of other people.
And I think I think against Joe Ross, too, I think people are going to be disinclined to play him because people tend to like Ross. So I can see him being very low owned with a lot of upside.
So Derek and I are splitting this lineup. I'm putting it in. It's the MLB 100K Saturday night special, 25,000 to first. Derek and I will be splitting any profits. I don't know if I told you that, but I do that for any guests who come on the show who have a bit of a reputation. It's a little of my way of saying thank you for doing the podcast. Our lineup is John Lester, Alex Wood, Buster Posey, Mitch Moreland, Rough Ned Odor, Derek Dietrich, Carlos Correa, George Springer, Chris Heisey, and Mr. Stanton. Any last comments before we go?
No, I like that. I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you for having me on, Todd.
I really enjoyed it, and hopefully we can talk again soon. Take care,
definitely.
Derek. I'm going to leave everyone with a song, and what am I going to play? Hopefully, you know, when we're playing a $40 tournament, I could use a miracle tonight. How about you, Derek?
That would be nice.
All right, we're going to leave with Jefferson Starship from the late 70s, Miracles. Thanks again, Derek, for doing the Run to Daylight podcast. Very much appreciated.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
You believe like I believe. make me wanna snow.